from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm John Sepulvedo in for Michael Krasny. Yesterday in the United States, two lawsuits have been brought against President Trump's proposed changes to who is eligible for asylum. And just yesterday, a federal court right here in San Francisco is what I meant to say earlier, placed a temporary halt to Trump's asylum ban, which would make it impossible for people who have illegally entered the United States to apply for asylum. Here to help us understand all of this is reporter and my California Report co-host, Lily Jamali, who was at the hearing yesterday. Hi, Lily.
Hi, John.
Tell us a little bit about what the government was saying they wanted to do with this policy.
So essentially what they were saying, and it is complicated, is that if an asylum seeker came to the U.S. Between ports of entry, i.e. illegally, mm-hmm. so they didn't come and presented a proper border crossing, that those people could no longer even attempt to apply for asylum.
Okay.
Now, that is at odds with what civil rights groups like the ACLU have been arguing, which is that immigration law passed by Congress makes it very clear. There's no doubt about what the law says, which is that it doesn't matter how you got here, you are allowed to, at the very least, apply for asylum.
Yeah, that was my understanding, too, as I was covering this, is like that if it doesn't matter how people got in, they could come in by plane, they can get, and that was part of the reason that the visa requirements were so difficult from mm-hmm. some countries. So it's going to be interesting. Apparently, the judge says at least there's enough to this merit by the ACLU that they're going to put in this restriction so that it can't be done right away, what the Trump administration wants.
Yeah, what the judge said was he essentially gave the ACLU exactly what it wanted in yesterday's hearing, which is a temporary restraining order. So that temporary restraining order can only last for 28 days.
Okay.
So they kind of have 4 weeks to play with here, and then the parties will return to court in December. At that point, we're going to probably be looking at a more permanent fix. So they're going to be looking for what's called a preliminary injunction. So saying, you know, this can't happen again. And even though it's preliminary, the idea is the ACLU will likely just try to get some sort of indefinite halt to this. If they get that preliminary injunction, it could just end up in the appeals process such that it really never comes back into the mix as a policy.
Did the government explain why this was necessary in this hearing?
Yeah, the government attorney, in pretty colorful language at one point, described what he called a crisis at the border. So we've been hearing a lot about this migrant caravan. We now know that somewhere on the order of 3,000 people from said caravan have already arrived at the California-Mexico border. And so the idea was that, you know, we're already in crisis mode. This migrant caravan is only making things worse. And it was interesting hearing them talk about how wait times can be days and weeks. Both sides agree that it's, you know, kind of a disaster down there in terms of how long it actually takes to be properly mm-hmm. processed. And then yesterday, we also saw part of the border crossing into the U.S. at San Ysidro shut down. The CPB, the CBP, I should say, Customs and Border Protection shut down several lanes northbound into the U.S. Those lanes continue to be closed, although they've reopened some of them. And so it kind of feeds into the ACLU's argument that, you know, it's already really hard to get in through normal channels. So, you know, part of their argument, I should mention, the ACLU's argument is that, you know, there are people who try to come through normal means, but it's not easy. The wait times are long. While they're languishing on the Mexican side of the border,
right.
they are at risk.
Right.
Got to remember, these are people who are fleeing persecution and
right.
violence in those Northern Triangle countries, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole host of reasons why people end up at an unofficial border crossing.
Yeah, you know, a lot of it too is one of the things in Tijuana, there is essentially a book that's kept where
mm-hmm.
people's names are put into at this port of entry. This book tends to favor, as it, you know, I can understand the logic behind this, women with children,
mm-hmm.
people with significant issues, maybe young infants. You'd see a lot of Russians and Chinese folks who are fleeing the government there. What I think is interesting, though, is that this has created a humanitarian crisis when it comes to young men. I have a source who I first met who was trying to apply for asylum, I think back in March. His name is Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
He calls me about three times a day looking for money, help, because he's desperate, because he has not been able to get in front of an asylum Judd, or as part of me, as Asylum Credible Fear interview, because his name keeps getting bumped on the list for other people.
Oh, wow.
Meanwhile, he doesn't have the shelter space. Meanwhile, he doesn't have a way to support himself. He's from Honduras. So it would seem that just based on that one little anecdote, that the ACLU would have to acknowledge that many people are trying to come other than the port of entry. How do they defend the ACLU? How do they defend people making that decision to cross into the country through an unauthorized port of entry?
Yeah, so one of the arguments that you will hear, and I kind of alluded to this a moment ago, is that some people just kind of end up at an unofficial port of entry.
We should say an
point of entry.
Because
they don't know where to go. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, coming back to an anecdote, a woman I was speaking to recently told me about a mom who had crossed the border with her two kids, and one of them ended up in Miami. And she goes, "Where is Miami?" You know, just to give you a sense of like, you know, these folks are really disoriented in a lot of cases. They don't know the geography. They don't know how things work procedurally. The ACLU has also argued that people often end up between points of entry because criminal elements push them there.
And essentially just dump them, promise them to drop them in a good place.
And then the other thing we're hearing is that Mexican authorities and U.S. border authorities are in some cases telling folks who are at an official point of entry to go to another one, sometimes miles away. And that, you know, and that can be very onerous for folks in terms of transportation issues.
To go to that point of disorientation, even if people aren't disorientated themselves, a lot of them don't know U.S. geography. I mean, it might be hard to believe from a U.S. perspective, but when I was in Guatemala earlier this year, I met several people who had never heard of San Francisco and never heard of New York City, which to me is like, how can anybody not? And then you realize you're not the biggest person on the planet.
Well, those granular examples are really important because, you know, a lot of what we heard in the courtroom was you know, fairly abstract. But those examples really help us understand what's happening on the ground and help you contextualize the government argument, which is that this is a national security threat, that the immigration and asylum systems are taxed, they can't handle more traffic. But when you hear, you know, those particular stories, it helps you understand what individuals are actually going through.
And also how hard it is to process folks, because if they don't have those types of orientations, if they don't have the proper documents, it can create quite the backlog. We've heard that from Customs and Border Protection as well. We want folks to give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. What do you think about this immigration policy? Have you been paying attention to the evolving humanitarian potential for crisis in Tijuana? And what do you think about this? We want to know from you. 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. We're going to go now to reporter Emily Green. She was covering what's happening in Tijuana for us yesterday on the California Report, and she joins us now. Hey, Em, how are you doing? Emily, can you hear me? Well, she was trying to join us from Mexico. We'll go back to her in just a moment. Obviously, we're not connecting with her, but we're going to go now to Sarah Pierce, who's a policy analyst and there's Emily Green. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Hey there. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. I know that you've been working many, many hours and that you have been doing a lot of traveling. You actually traveled with this caravan. Let's start with just some basics about them. We're hearing from the Trump administration that many of these folks are young men looking to take jobs and are even considering storming the border. In fact, I was on the U.S. side where I saw Marines put up barricades and fencing to stop what they thought were going to be these, quote, invaders. Does that square with what you saw on the ground?
That does not square with what I saw on the ground. That said, I did talk to several people who said, I asked them what their plans were for getting into the U.S. One woman stands out to me. She says, when more migrants arrive, they are going to walk en masse across the border and try and get in. Now, it did not sound like an invasion. It sounded like they were trying to present themselves as one big group with the hope that somehow, somewhere, U.S. immigration authorities will let them in. I tried to dissuade her from this idea that this would actually happen, but that is being talked about. So I don't want to completely discount that, but it's not like a running across the border and trying to overwhelm the immigration authorities. That's not the way I'm hearing it.
So, Emily, what you're saying, and I actually haven't heard this as anything serious from this caravan, you're hearing that there is actual talk of presenting themselves as one group. Like, are they at a port of entry or just walking up to a border guard? Like, I'm just very...
Right.
How would it work?
I don't think they actually know themselves. I mean, they've never crossed the bridge from Tijuana into San Diego.
Right.
So I don't think they have an idea of how they will do it. I did interview one woman who says there has to be a deal to let us in because there are too many of us. So I think the sense of if they go as one big group, then somehow maybe immigration authorities would feel overwhelmed and say, fine, you know, just come in or some of you can come in. And, you know, to some extent that did happen on the border between Honduras and Mexico,
right.
Although in the end, most of the migrants ended up crossing into Mexico illegally.
You mean Guatemala and Mexico?
Between Guatemala and Mexico, excuse me. And so, I think that there's a sense of what do we do? Maybe if we go as one big group, some of us will get in. I mean, that is out there. But let me just be clear. Also, there is no plan right now that I know of in place to actually do that.
Emily, stand by with me. I want to go back to Lily Jamali now. If I'm, you know, you've watched this, the Trump administration argue in court, and, you know, even if this is a loose plan, just the fact that they're talking about it, this is what the Trump administration is saying is going to happen. I mean, I imagine government attorneys would be very happy to hear what Emily is saying. It would seem to validate their policy.
Yeah. And another, you know, area that they're pressing hard on is the idea that they're seeing resources diverted away from doing this the right way and ending up putting a lot of effort into apprehending people at these unofficial crossings. By their estimate, something on the order of 400,000 people were apprehended in the last fiscal year. It's important to contextualize that, though, because that is a low that we haven't seen since, I believe it's 1971.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like a lot. When you put it in context, you see, you know, even just the various approaches that the Trump administration has taken on immigration policy do seem to be deterring people.
Emily, I want to go back now to you because I want to talk about the other big story that's happening with these migrants in Tijuana, which is that many of the residents actually seem to be embracing a form of Trumpism. I saw protesters with hats that said, "Make Tijuana Great Again." And according to your reporting and other reports I read, they were essentially telling these migrants to get out of their community. Help us set the scene. Where is this community at in Tijuana? Tell us about how these migrants were received by many of the neighbors.
Right. So right now, the migrants are being housed in a municipal sports complex, an outdoor municipal sports complex in Tijuana. And
on the playas, right?
No, it's not on the playas. It's in sort of the center of town. It's basically a 15-minute walk from the bridge connecting San Diego and Tijuana. And they're camped out there. They have tents. There are porta potties. There are about 2,500 people now and many more on the way, both in Mexicali, which is about an hour from Tijuana, and also more migrants in routes from Mexico City. I would still say that the vast majority of Tijuanans support them and empathize with them. I do not have any statistics to back that up, so, you know, I could be wrong there, but that's my sense. But there is a small and very vocal group of Tijuanans who are opposed to them and use the same language as President Trump, calling them invaders. And I think in general what this caravan and caravans has exposed is an undercurrent of discomfort with migrants in Tijuana. And to have so many arrive en masse at the same time is really uncomfortable for them. The Tijuana mayor himself has been, I would say, far from welcoming, kind of accused, inflamed attitudes by accusing them of being criminals and bad seeds and sort of already wrecking havoc in Tijuana. I don't think that's the case, but he's very much sort of inflaming attitudes in that way. But in general, you know, I think one of the, I was talking to a local journalist, and one of the concerns that maybe hasn't been fully talked about is that you have to understand just how important this port of entry, this bridge connecting Tijuana to San Diego is. Mm. Thousands, perhaps millions cross every day from Mexico into San Diego to go to work. So any threat to their livelihood is just absolutely terrifying to them. And yesterday, the immigration authorities or Customs and Border Patrol closed the lanes from Mexico into San Diego as if confirming their fear that this migrant of caravans is going to eat into their livelihood. And so, you know, I think there's xenophobia. And I think that there is an anti-migrant attitude. And I think at the same time, they're very worried, what does this mean for us? I mean, if all of a sudden the U.S. is closing the lanes between Mexico into the U.S. on a regular basis, that could be very devastating for them.
Emily Green, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Emily, of course, a freelance reporter based in Mexico City. Emily, thanks.
Thank you.
Lily, tell us, you were letting me, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it almost seems like, you know, I don't think this is a stretch, that the Trump administration is building a case that these people are violent. And so with the San Ysidro crossing, which we talked about earlier, and Emily alluded to it again there.
The busiest border crossing that we know of in the world.
You know, you have these really powerful images that Secretary Kristen Nielsen of the Homeland Security Department tweeted out yesterday showing this show of force.
Right.
And, you know, quite dramatic pictures. And coupled with, you know, in the proclamation and the language that we're hearing from President Trump saying that these are people who entered Mexico with some violence. Mm-hmm. And so, again, we come back to this notion that they are trying to make an argument and using various bits of evidence that they can gather.
And putting a lot of pressure on people in Tijuana. I actually lived in Tijuana, worked in San Diego. It used to be very quick to get back and forth. It's much, much longer now. Even if you do have Sentry passes and the rest, we're starting to see the wait lines go up and up. So to hear that even two lanes close is just...
Oh, we're talking about something like 10 or 12. We just verified that with the Customs
Anybody
and Border Protection.
Anybody who's ever waited in that line just,
this morning.
It's awful. Let's go to Demetrius in Half Moon Bay. Demetrius, welcome for joining us. Thank you for joining us. Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. I have a question and a comment. My question is, as a country that accepts refugees and welcomes refugees, I think it would be important to clarify what is a refugee. Because from what I understand and from even some of the valid reports that I've seen there, camp or group that are coming, and the ones before it, there were people who were escaping their countries because of gang violence, because somebody's husband was beating them and somebody's wife was beating them, and because there was no jobs. Mm-hmm. So is it for any reason that somebody doesn't like their country, we have to grant them asylum? Or is it really some sort of a governmental and political persecution that we ought to grant people asylum?
That's a great question, Demetrius. In fact, we saw the rules with Jeff Sessions change about that. President Obama often said that women were targeted groups because the government couldn't protect women. So domestic violence and gang violence, things like that, counted. The Department of Justice under Attorney General Jeff Sessions reversed that. That is something that's being litigated. And it's something that our next guest, Sarah Pierce, a policy analyst and immigration lawyer at the Migration Policy Institute, can talk about. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So let's answer Demetrius's question. What has been the change regarding who is granted asylum and why?
Sure. So when we're talking about refugees or asylees, we're talking about individuals who are fleeing persecution on the basis of race, religion, political affiliation, or membership in a particular social group. And what exactly membership of a particular social group means is something that has been the subject of massive amounts of litigation. And before the Trump administration took office, there was a line of case law saying that membership in a particular social group could mean women. It could mean women who are specifically fleeing domestic violence. And it also opened up the possibility that certain individuals who are fleeing gang violence would also qualify as asylees. While Jeff Sessions was in office, he reversed that. So he effectively reversed a long series, really decades long, of case law on this issue. And he made it much more difficult for individuals who are fleeing gang or domestic violence to qualify for asylum.
You know, what's interesting about that, Sarah, is when you actually read the memo that Jeff Sessions wrote and you do a keyword search within the PDF of it, the electronic version of it, the Central American countries come up like 20 some odd times as he refers to this. And it made me think, as a journalist and as somebody who's skeptical of every single person living on the planet, including myself, that this was really done to help curb Central American migration. Am I wrong in thinking that? And is that one of the arguments that's being presented in court?
I think it's a really strong hypothesis, at the very least, especially when you look more holistically at everything this administration is doing on asylum and on policies related to the southern border. I mean, this president campaigned on immigration, and specifically his key issue on the campaign trail was a border wall. So he's been very sensitive to flows across our southern border. And right now, the way the laws stand, the only people who can really get past our southern border are asylum seekers or unaccompanied child migrants. So we've seen this administration take a real thoughtful and comprehensive approach to this issue. And you're right, it is being litigated. There is a case, Grace v. Sessions, that's happening here on the East Coast to see whether or not Sessions' change on this membership of particular social group issue was actually legal and constitutional.
So I'm going to ask you to stay with us, and I want to go back to Lily Jamali just because I want to offer it. So we have this crisis that's kind of unfolding, a human crisis in Tijuana. We're seeing that there's been a lot of pressure on the southern U.S. border.
Mm-hmm.
You have come to us from Canada, and I'm curious, are we seeing the same type of pressure? When you would cross over and maybe Toronto, driving to Buffalo, because you love Buffalo, I don't know if you do.
I do love Buffalo.
So when you come over, were we seeing the same type of border buildup?
No, absolutely not. And overall, it's a very easy border to cross, I would imagine, by comparison. I haven't crossed at San Ysidro in a number of years myself. But I did go to high school there, as you did. And so, you know, I remember it would be just crazy long lines to get in and out. You could never forget your documentation. And I have crossed into Canada with, you know, a copy of my passport on my phone. You know, I don't think you could do that at the Mexico border. What I will say, on that point, is one of the things that really struck me about what the Department of Justice attorney said yesterday in court. Mm-hmm. At the very end, and this has been sort of forgotten, is he said part of this is like a part of the negotiation that the Trump administration is having with Mexican officials about immigration policy between the two countries, which brings me to the U.S. and Canada have something called the Safe Third Country Agreement. And what mm-hmm. that means is if you land in one country or the other as an asylum seeker, you have to stay in that country and go through the asylum process in the first country that you arrive in.
Okay.
And so what they're trying to do, to my understanding, is negotiate a similar agreement with
Mexico,
which mm-hmm. would mean if you go from Guatemala to Mexico, you're doing this in Mexico. You're not coming here to do that, which is exactly what the Trump administration wants.
Sarah, can you help us understand a little bit about, we can understand the safe third party. That would mean that, you know, folks from Guatemala would have to apply in Mexico. And that would be, as Lily just said, what the Trump administration wants. Is there any reason why there would be a lesser border presence up in Canada as opposed to San Ysidro or Tornillo, Texas, or Nogales, Arizona?
I mean, there's just the fact of geography that we have all of these Central American countries and that putting on pressure on Mexico and then our southern border. So there's that. I mean, there's also the fact that, of course, we don't have the same safe third country agreement with Mexico. This administration's moves are actually designed to put pressure on Mexico. In fact, the president was very explicit about that in his proclamation, that the design of this was to place pressure on Mexico so Mexico would eventually agree to the safe third country agreement. But we don't have any such agreement in place.
Lily?
And I will also add to that, don't be fooled and think that the Trump administration is doing absolutely nothing on immigration policy towards Canada. But it's a very different animal. What I reported on before I moved down here was the Trump administration going after, for example, Canadian executives and people with so-called specialized knowledge, i.e. techies, trying to make it harder for them to come to the U.S. to work. I mean, what an interesting classification to go after. And what that really shows you is that this is linked to a lot of other things, like NAFTA, for example. At the time, we didn't have this newly renegotiated NAFTA deal, which is called the USMCA. And it kind of helps you understand how Trump sees all of these things as linked. You know, it's not just immigration. It's not just politics. It's about trade and lots of other things.
Sarah, I'm interested if you have seen something that has surprised you with regards to the Trump administration policy, that you would, even barring the rhetoric and this type of economic nationalism that Lily is talking about, something that even to you stands out and goes, huh, I would never have thought that would happen.
I think what regularly surprises me is just how thoughtful and comprehensive the administration and consistent the administration is on immigration. We at one point went back and looked at the one real policy speech that President Trump gave on the campaign trail. It was a 10-point plan on immigration, and he's really going through each of those points. They've been very consistent on that. And, you know, when you're just looking at this asylum reform, the administration is being very thoughtful, very thorough, and very comprehensive. There are policies to impede asylum seekers at the border, at the preliminary interview stage, and at the court stage now. And just seeing all of that and seeing how consistent they are and how thoughtful, I think that regularly surprises me and makes me a little fearful about what we're going to see next.
Sarah Pierce, I'm going to ask you to stay with us. Lily Jamali, I'm going to ask you to do the same. We're going to talk to Jose Antonio Vargas in just a moment about his experience as an undocumented immigrant, but we're going to continue our immigration discussion. We also want to hear from our listeners. You can also tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Stay with us. Welcome to Forum. I'm John Sepulveda, in for Michael Krasny. Later this hour, we're going to talk with Jose Antonio Vargas about his new book. For the moment, though, we're going to continue this conversation that we began last hour talking about immigration policy from the Trump administration, specifically how it deals with folks coming up from Central America. Joining us in studio is Lily Jamali, a co-host and correspondent for KQED's The California Report. Happens to be my favorite program. Hi, Lily.
Mine too. Hi, John.
And Sarah Pierce, a policy analyst and immigration lawyer at the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you for joining us, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I want to get back to something you said last hour, which is that, you know, a lot of the criticism towards the Trump administration is that he's unfocused. This administration isn't able to do anything. They're kind of scattershot. But you were mentioning, and this is something that has bared out, I think, that this immigration policy and the economic policy behind it, it really seems to be well organized and very calculated.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, just when you're looking at asylum, since this is kind of the issue that the administration is focusing most on at the moment, we've seen policies that are meant to impede asylum seekers along the border. That would include metering at ports of entry, and it would include the policy that was just hung up in the courts last night, which would have disqualified individuals who would cross in between ports of entry from applying for asylum. Then we've seen policies that will make it more difficult for asylum seekers to qualify at the preliminary stage of asylum, the credible fear interview, and policies that make it more difficult for asylum seekers once they get before an immigration judge, if they're able to get before an immigration judge. Just last night, the administration made a change to the immigration court system that says that asylum seekers, their cases should be adjudicated within 180 days. And that's really extraordinary when you consider how backlogged our immigration court system is and the fact that people really right now aren't getting hearings until 2022.
Yeah, I was going to say that sounds almost impossible. Like, that's like me saying I'm going to lose 40 pounds tomorrow. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. I think that's a great analogy.
Yeah, thank you. You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also tweet us. We are at KQED Forum. We want to read your comments. And Sarah, I actually have a question for you. Overall, this comes from a listener who tweeted us. Overall, immigration, both legal and illegal, it has been down since the Bush, well, since the 2008 recession. Is that true? They were wondering if this is accurate or not.
It's true. It's definitely true for illegal immigration. We saw it dip with the 2008 recession. And then since then, it has ticked back up a little bit, but it's still at historic lows. For example, illegal apprehensions during fiscal year 2018 were a quarter of what they were in year 2000. For legal immigration, I actually don't think it's true that it's lower. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but it would surprise me if legal immigration had decreased, because we have big backlogs of a lot of people that are really waiting and really really wanting to come in and get U.S. green cards.
And Sarah, what is the argument for asylum? We've heard the argument against asylum many times on KQED. We've heard that from Border Patrol officials who say that a lot of these asylum claims are bogus. They come with cards. The folks come with cards in their hands. They have prepared statements to make, that they're really economic refugees, that they're not really political asylum seekers. But yet there is a law that has been passed by Congress and a treaty approved by the Senate that allows for people to apply for asylum. What did, at the time, did people see as the benefits of having people apply for asylum? Why was that approved in the first place?
And we really came together as an international community in 1951 to recognize the obligations that we have towards those who are persecuted, to those who are truly suffering in their home countries. And that's the obligation we've carried forward here, is towards both refugees and asylees. The only difference between the two being that refugees are far off and asylum seekers are really at our doorstep asking for those protections.
We want to hear how folks came to the U.S., both legally, illegally, maybe otherwise. I don't know if a third possibility exists, but if it does, we want to hear about it. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Of course, we're very sensitive to the fact that many people are not able to give their names if they're in this country in an undocumented capacity. So with that, if you call in at 866-733-6786, we don't have to use your phone or your name. We won't record your phone number. And you can also send us a message through email. We won't read your message that way, by identifying your name, forum@kqed.org. Again, give us a call, 866-733-6786. Lily, separation of power. You want to say something about that?
I do. I want to just talk about how this case is really the latest, ding to the Trump administration's immigration policy to come from the judiciary, to come from the courts. And that's important. We saw in particular the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, based here in San Francisco, has been a real thorn in President Trump's side on immigration. We saw that with the first Muslim ban, the first iteration of that on sanctuary law. And it's really important. And I think, sometimes we forget that President Trump has made some serious inroads in remaking the judiciary. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to do that here in California on
the Ninth Circuit
in particular. Yeah. Dianne Feinstein, one of our U.S. senators, has expressed concern about, generally you get some say in which judges get appointed to your home state, and Trump is breaking with tradition on that. So that's really important. And then the other thing is, I just wanted to read you something from what Judge John Tiger of the U.S. District Court said in his ruling yesterday. He said, whatever the scope of the president's authority, he may not rewrite the immigration laws to impose a condition that Congress has expressly forbidden. So we've talked about the judiciary. But we're also talking about the judiciary stepping in to say, you're the executive branch and Congress has, that's the legislative branch. You can't infringe on their turf. And this is their turf very clearly.
You know what, Sarah, on Lily's point on the separation of powers, you know, President Obama wanted to bring immigration policy, of course, almost 180 degrees. Well, let's say 90 degrees different than where President Trump is. And the truth of the matter is he was really constrained. So even with the executive actions he was able to take, we've seen a lot of court action about that, a lot of court battles. And we've seen that each president has kind of been able to work within the confines of the law based on how they see fit, and that President Trump is just kind of continuing that tradition, albeit very different policies.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summary of what's happening. I mean, in reality, we haven't had a Congress act on our immigration law in decades. And I think as those laws become continually outdated and as we have presidents who are promising big changes on immigration, presidents are continually forced to act out as executives and trying to test and push the boundaries of that executive power. And I think there are some definitely interesting parallels into what we've seen President Obama and President Trump what they've been doing
in their own capacity. Again, we're asking people to tell us how they came to this country, to the great state of California, if they live here. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Sarah, before we let you go, I wanted to tell you about how my family came here, because my grandmother was an undocumented person. She was an illegal immigrant, but she illegally voted in elections. She collected Social Security illegally, even though she didn't pay into it. And she's actually buried in a national cemetery next to my grandfather, who was in the country legally because he fought in World War II. The reason she got away with all of this, though, she always said, was because she was Scottish and she was able to pass as a U.S. As a white person. It seems that there have been throughout the U.S. history this type of double standard, that some immigrants are allowed if they kind of fit with the majority, and others, like right now Central Americans and the rest in past years, Chinese, Japanese, the Irish, that we've seen a great amount of discrimination based on the kind of values and cultures of the time.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary. In the past, we actually had an immigration system that was really outright racist. It outright preferred individuals of certain nationalities over others. Then in 1965, we enacted this major reform that was supposed to get away from that national origin system. But we definitely still have relics of it in our system today.
Sarah, I want to thank you so much. Sarah Pierce is a policy analyst and immigration lawyer with the Migration Policy Institute. She stayed with us late. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Lily, I want to ask you a personal question, if you don't mind. How did your family come to the country?
My family came from Iran. My dad is a physician. My mom is a dentist. And they came because of my father's profession. Like a lot of people from any place in the world, they just wanted to live their lives in America. It was their dream to do so. And that's really what it was. They came several years before the Iranian Revolution of 1979. I'm sure you're familiar with how that really changed several regions of our state, primarily in the Los Angeles area. So certainly we saw an influx of Iranian immigrants after the revolution there in Washington, D.C., and really kind of a handful of other enclaves throughout the country.
Lily Jamali is the co-host of the California Report. Thanks for sharing that personal story, by the way.
Thank you.
I wanted to use that to pivot to calls we are asking from our folks to call. If you're listening, 866-733-6786, about how you came to the country, how you came to the state. And we're doing so because we're going to talk to Jose Antonio Vargas, who just wrote a book, Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. He joins us now. Jose, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we've been asking our callers and folks about how they came to the country. Jose, tell us how you came to the country.
Yeah, so, well, I woke up one morning in the Philippines and my mom said I was going to America. And my suitcase was already packed and she got me to the airport and we said goodbye. And you know, I don't really even know how we said goodbye. And the last thing she said to me was, here's a jacket, it might get cold there. And then I was in a plane and then I arrived in Mountain View, California in the Bay Area in 1993. To live with my grandparents when I was 12. I thought everything was fine because they're both naturalized U.S. citizens. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until about 4 years after I arriving here when I was 16 to get a driver's permit, like any 16-year-old, that's when I found out that the green card that my grandfather had given me was fake.
Wow.
So that's how I found out. And this was in 97. You know, it's not like I can Google. There was no Googling anything.
Right.
And whenever the radio station or the television or movies, whenever anybody said anything about quote-unquote illegal people, they always said it was about Mexican. It was always about the border or the wall.
Right.
And I'm from the Philippines, and so I'm like, you know, I thought I was the only non-Mexican, quote-unquote, illegal alien. And I have to say that, by the way, because I wonder what happens when little kids listening to programs like this, when they hear that word, you know, referring to their family members, illegal, illegal, illegal. I wonder what that, you know, what that does to people. But yeah, so that's how I found out. And luckily for me, I grew up in the Bay Area, and I grew up in Mountain View specifically. And if it wasn't for all the mentors and teachers and educators at Mountain View High School, I'm not quite sure what would happen to me. Mm. So they kind of became a big part of trying, you know, I was always this problem that there was no solution for.
Right.
And every teacher that found out, the high school principal, my high school superintendent, all of them tried to help. And this was before there was any language around this. Like, there was no Dream Act, right? And so I'm saying all of this to kind of accentuate the fact that even though we're living in this very, very fraught time, I'm a huge fan, by the way, of the Migration Policy Institute, huge fan. Everybody should check out their website. You know, we are living through probably the most anti-immigrant era in modern U.S. history. I mean, the only analogy would be the 1920s. Right, when we had really racist immigration policies against specific nationalities.
Well, we had racism in the 1920s. I mean, it was just this rebirth of a Confederate glory. It wasn't just against, not that it makes it any better or worse. It was just the country got caught up in a racist fever from the president on down.
But then again, of course, you know, African Americans and Native Americans
for
would
sure.
argue the very founding
Absolutely.
Of the country.
Yes.
And that's the thing, by the way, too. Like, whenever we like to talk about America being a country of immigrants, I think it's important that we recognize the fact that when we say that, we leave two groups of people out of that equation, Native Americans and African Americans. And I love that you're asking this question to the audience, because as far as I'm concerned, if you're not a Native American or an African American who was brought here through slavery, you have to answer three questions. Where did you come from? Me, the Philippines. How'd you get here? I was smuggled. How much did it cost? Who paid? My grandfather, $4,500. If you can't answer those questions, then you don't really have a right to obsess over a border that you don't understand.
Yeah. Jose, I want you to stay with us, because we've been putting the shout out to folks to call us and give us their thoughts. And we're going to cycle through some of those calls before we talk about your book. And then I'm going to do for this format is I'm going to let the callers call or talk. And then, Jose, I want you to respond and how you see fit. We're going to go to Paul in Cupertino. Paul, you want to talk about the asylum policy, I see, specifically with domestic violence issues. Paul, are you there? Cupertino. Sorry. Also, I wanted to say thanks, Jose, for shouting out Mountain View High School. We don't give enough credit to high school teachers and other folks who help shape us, so thank you for that. David in Fresno. David, what is your comment? David, you're on the radio while you're driving.
Yes, I'm so sorry.
Are you hands-free? I want to make sure you don't crash.
Yes,
I don't want any accidents.
I'm actually walking his floor now.
Oh, okay, good.
So, yeah, I was smuggled into the U.S. when I was a kid. My aunt and my uncle both crossed the border, and they brought me and my brother back to the U.S. My dad was a legal resident at the time, and then 5 years later, I got my green card. And I think the problem is that we can't really find like a distinct line into whether a situation is fine to be able to allow someone into this country or not. And I think that's where it's a convoluted issue, you know.
David, will you do me a favor? I know you're walking, but just stop for a second, and I want you to re-say what you're saying, because I think what you have to say is very important. But if you're anything like me, you can't walk and talk and think about anything. So I just want you to focus for 30 seconds. Tell us what exactly you're trying to say.
Well, I think if Trump really wants to pay attention to his border wall and to find a way to fund it, I think he should focus more on the northern border, just because it is easier to fly to Canada, and Canada now has a policy with Mexico as of July of this past year, if not June,
right,
where they allow people to fly there, and then so people could technically just go that way so much faster, and it's probably safer.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying, and I thank you for saying it, David. You know, Jose, I maybe talk a little bit about the fact that to David's more general point, which is that people are going to find a way to get in this country. We've been doing it, you know, as Westerners, Europeaners, Asians. We've been coming to this country since its foundation. I mean, we know that there are ways to get in. If they close the southern border, people will come in through Puerto Rico or other areas. Talk about that.
Well, I think the bigger question is, has humanity ever built a border that could withstand human will? You know, so long as parents have to feed their kids, they're going to cross whatever border you put in front of them. Like the Irish, I've been recently fascinated with Irish history. I didn't really know much about it. I didn't know that after the potato famine wiped out so many parts of Ireland, that people got on what they called coffin ships, because so many people died on their way here,
yeah,
just to come. You know, some people would argue that the Atlantic Ocean was a huge border, right? That people had to come here with no papers, because there was no visa required. There were no green cards required. There was no border patrol. There was no ICE. There was no INS. They showed up. But that journey itself, and this is, I think, to me, is what's so really dangerous about what's happening in this country. I mean, the policies, of course, yes, but the rhetoric, right? Mm. Like, the inherent courage that it takes to leave what you know and go to a place that you don't know, right? To build a life for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That is inherently courageous. That is the kind of entrepreneurial quality that this country was built on. You know, I mean, I hate to kind of just always talk about the fact that, you know, Silicon Valley is built by tech entrepreneurs, right? But it's also the entrepreneurial quality that it takes to cross a border and farm and harvest strawberries and
right.
potatoes for people and tomatoes. You know what I mean? Like,
no, absolutely. My grandmother was a strawberry harvester. My other grandmother, my Mexican-American grandmother, was a strawberry harvester in Watsonville. I understand that part. But the other thing about this, Jose, is that with the many, many multitudes of people who come in looking for that entrepreneurial quality, unfortunately, there are people who commit crime, or there are people who do horrible things. How, as a society, go ahead.
I mean, that's kind of like saying that there are many, you know, white men who decide to blow up buildings and go into stores and kill people, right? Like, here's actually the really big thing that's really important for people to understand. Undocumented people are just like anybody else. We're no more special. We're no less special, right? We're just as heroic. We're just as mercenary. Like, we shouldn't put people in any sort of pedestal, or we shouldn't put them in a place where all of a sudden we're expecting more out of them. Although, I would argue that undocumented people in this country, you have to build kind of a certain kind of resilience. You know, I mean, to me, that's miraculous, right? We're in the Bay Area talking about this, right? Like, imagine being undocumented in the state of Texas. There's a 1.8 million undocumented people in the state of Texas, and you cannot drive. Undocumented people in Texas cannot drive. So can you imagine, like, drive? I mean, I'm sorry. Is there a subway station I don't know about in Houston or Dallas? I don't think so.
No, there's absolutely. So as somebody who's lived in Texas, the public transit is awful.
Awful. Yes. So yeah. people are literally risking their lives every day just to drop the kid to school, just to go to work, just to go to Walmart. In the Obama, you know, not only what that was happening in the Obama era, but in the Trump era.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's something miraculous about the fact that against all of that, people get up every day just to live their lives and provide for their families. I mean, that to me is miraculous.
We're talking with Jose Antonio Vargas. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He is also the author of Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Jose, stay with us. We're going to talk about your book. But first, we're going to hear from people's calls after the break. We want to hear your American story, your Californian story. Tell us how you got to this country, how your family came here. We want to hear from you. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. And to the callers on the line, we see you and we'll hear you in just a moment. You're listening to Forum. I'm John Sepulveda in for Michael Krasny. We're talking with Jose Antonio Vargas. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, activist, and author of Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. Jose, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get to your book, we're going to cycle through some calls and listen to some folks. And the way we're going to do this is I'm just going to have them talk, and then I'll turn it over to you to respond. Let's go to Regina in Sonoma. Regina, you're on Forum.
Okay, thank you. My question is, how can political asylum be justified for gang violence people when we have gang violence here in this country?
Regina, thanks. And Jose, I'm curious about your response, because that's something we often hear is, you know, we have issues in the United States, issues here in California. How can we take on people we're facing similar issues in other countries when we haven't solved the problems for us who live here?
Well, I think part of that is to interrogate why the problems exist in the first place, right? So what has happened when our criminal justice system has actually deported gang members from the United States to, say, for example, El Salvador, right? And how does that contribute kind of to the cycle of violence that comes in and out? Like, what's the connection there, right? I would have to say, though, like, you know, I mean, and that's something that we have to draw a line in, right? If people are murderers, you know, like, of course, there's due process of law, but we don't want murderers, right? However, I think too often, like, those kind of stories about gang violence or about, you know, murders take over the entire conversation, when the reality is they make up a very small percentage of the immigrant population or the asylee applicants or people who are trying to claim refugee status in the country.
They do, but it is an emotional argument, and I hear what you're saying, I've lived in other countries before, and I've heard it in other countries. Like, why should we do for someone who's not part of our tribe when we have problems within our tribe? I mean, I think that's a question as old as time itself.
But again, how did those problems happen, right? So when we deport gang members in this country to the countries, like, for example, again, El Salvador, where, like, you know, MS-13 is, right? Mm-hmm. So how does that contribute to kind of the cycle of violence that's happening? You know, I was on Fox News I think right before the midterms.
I'm sorry.
It's important. I think it's really important to talk to everybody about this. You know, as far as I'm concerned, this has been a bipartisan mess. Mm-hmm. So, and I was trying to explain that the caravan, isn't that amazing that, you know, President Trump was completely obsessed over it, and then the election happened and that we haven't heard really about the caravan. So when the caravan was taking over the news because of what President Trump was doing, we didn't really ask the questions of why did they have to flee in the first place, right? Like, and so I started asking on air on Fox News, like, what did the United States do during the 80s? And which sides in the civil wars in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, who did we side with to defeat communism? And how has that actually led to how unstable a lot of these countries are? Of course, their own countries are, you know, the governments of their own countries are responsible for this, but we've also contributed to it. So we can't think of America as like, oh, here we are here and they're over there, when our policies impact what's happening over there. Does that make sense when I say that?
No, I understand, and that's actually something that many journalists who have covered what's happened in Central and America and South Mexico and the Guerrero and Chiapas regions also said. You know, there are significant problems, and many of them, if not tied directly to U.S. foreign policy, can be looked at through the lens of U.S. corporate expansion into those areas. We're going to go to CJ in Castro Valley. CJ, welcome to Forum. CJ, are you there?
I'm here.
CJ, brother, you got to be ready. You got to be ready to go. And are you driving? Are you safe? Are you okay?
Yes. No, I'm driving, but I have it on hands-free.
All right. Well, okay,
I'm getting worried about these drivers.
I am too. Y'all need to be safe when you're calling for them. CJ, very briefly, tell us what you got.
So I came to America around 87.
Okay.
From Sri Lanka, and the reason was there was a lot of problems there. There was this LTTE group, and, you know, it was a terrorist group, and people were getting attacked, and you either have to join them or you get shot. So he applied to visas like 1,000 times, and finally got a student visa and came to America. I mean, me and a lot of other guys. I was about 17 years old. And Then when we were here, our main goal was to try to be legal because, you know, we were too scared to become illegal. Summer worked like 1,000 jobs to pay for school and went to school. And now, luckily, after 10 years, got a job in Silicon Valley and I got a green card.
And you're basically saying, CJ, if I'm hearing you right, if I'm cutting to the chase because I don't want you to crash your car, essentially, while you're talking to us, you're saying it's not fair for people to essentially jump the line. Is that right? All right, CJ, I want you to continue focusing on the road while we focus on answering your question. Jose, you've heard this before. I've heard this before. Why is it?
I'm sorry. Is CJ? Was that
his CJ, name? Yes.
I hope he's okay driving. Yeah. I have to say, though, let me make sure I get this right. So he wanted to make sure that he doesn't, quote unquote, become illegal. So then he got a visa because he's a tech worker, right? So maybe an H-1B visa.
Yes, probably.
And I'm saying this with all due respect because I went to high school.
In Menlo Park,
I went to high school in Mountain View.
Oh, Mountain View,
Workers. I know a lot of, you know, there is a difference between Menlo Park and Mountain View. So I wanted to make sure I differentiate that. So I really have to push back against this idea that because tech workers have a way to, quote unquote, right themselves in terms of their status, that all of a sudden the 11 million people who are here illegally just choose to be quote-unquote illegal, mm-hmm. right? Actually, probably that's one of the biggest things I get asked, even by journalists. Like, why don't you just get legal? As if all I have to do is, like, flip a switch and, oof, here I am, legal, on the way to U.S. citizenship, stealing your welfare.
Sure.
I just find that such incredibly simplistic and, of course, inaccurate.
Yeah,
right?
Well, and, of course, you can't apply for much of federally supported welfare, especially temporary.
And so CJ was almost making it sound like, wait a second, so all those undocumented migrant farmers that are harvesting strawberries, for example, mm-hmm. is there a visa process for them so that they can work legally while making sure that we have fruits and vegetables?
Well, there used to be a visa process for many
there
of them.
There used
who came,
to be,
yes,
absolutely.
Yes,
yes.
So I want to get back to the basic question, though, and I understand the specifics of it, though, but help us understand why, from your vantage point, you don't agree with this idea that when someone enters the country undocumented, as you did, it doesn't skip the line for the folks who have been waiting for visas, regardless of why they're able to get this visa. Help us understand.
Well, the problem there is that we're separating the two. When in reality, so for example, right? So I'm Filipinos. I'm sure you know somebody who are Filipinos. We have big ass families, right? Especially that's 4 million 4 million Filipinos in the United States, 2 million in California alone.
Yes.
Right. So I have 36 relatives in the great state of California, all of whom are either U.S. born citizens, naturalized citizens, or green card holders. So I am the only undocumented person in a family of 36 people in this country, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't separate me from my documented U.S. citizen relatives in the same way that there are uncles and aunts and cousins of mine in the Philippines who've been waiting for decades to come here legally. Do you know what I'm trying to say here?
I hear your point.
We're actually within the same family. So when you say to me that I'm skipping I'm trying to skip a line. No, I'm not. I'm trying to figure out where the line is. My relatives are waiting in line right now in the Philippines. Now, if you told me that I needed to wait 10 years or 20 years, right? Okay, tell me that. But there is no such process. There is no such line. And this idea that we're pitting people against each other, saying, oh, you know, like, he waited, why can't you wait? Well, I'm sorry, I've been waiting for 25 years. What else do you want me to do?
Jose Antonio Vargas, we're going to talk about his book in about 5 minutes. I want to take some more calls before we do. Eric in San Francisco. Eric, you're saying that you part of your family is from China. Tell us about this.
Hi, good morning. Yeah.
Good morning.
My dad was a paper son from China, and he came over here in 1937. And one of my great uncles, from what I know, he jumped ship in Cuba and made his way over to the U.S. And both sides of the both of them settled on the East Coast. My dad was a guarded POW during World War II. My brother fought in Vietnam. And, excuse me.
No, Eric, it's okay. Take your time, brother.
When I heard all this rhetoric from Trump about, quote-unquote, illegal immigrants and playing on people's fears about immigrants and race, it was really offensive. It made me think back to the 1800s when the newspapers portrayed Chinese as this yellow horde that was going to come over and kill everybody. And it was really, really offensive. My parents worked hard, and they raised 5 kids. And this country, our president has really divided this country. It sometimes makes me wonder about where I walk, about where I should go, what I can do. And that's all I wanted to say.
Eric, I wanted to, first of all, thank you for being brave. Because this ultimately is about identity. You know, these issues, I think it was very brave of you to share that, even though clearly you feel very emotional about it, as you should. Eric, thanks so much. I hope you have a great Thanksgiving. Jose, I want to go to you and just talk very briefly. I mean, this is an issue because at the end of the day, this is about identity, regardless of what folks say. I mean, that's the core issue here. There are a lot of emotions that run very high in this.
And I think people underestimate, I think, just how personal it is for people, right? Like, I'm really glad that Eric called and shared what he shared, because even when he was talking, I just kept thinking about birthright citizenship. I kept thinking about, you know, in many ways in this country, you know, this idea of birthright citizenship was really tested after the Reconstruction, right? When Black Americans wanted proof that when you're born in this country, you are a U.S. citizen. And it was challenged by actually a U.S.-born Chinese American who left the country. He was living in San Francisco, left the country to go to China, then tried to come back. And then we stopped him and said, wait a second, are you really American? And he was like, yes, I was born in the U.S. My parents are immigrants. I was born in the U.S. I'm an American. So our history has shown us that this has always been something we've been struggling with. Who we as a country define to be American? Because that's really what's at the table here. And, you know, I go back and forth here about, you know, Trump, meaning that, of course, what's happening in the Trump era, you know, when it comes to policies, when it comes to the rhetoric, is awful. But then I keep thinking about, I would rather know that this is a problem and this is what people think than not know.
That it's that, and for you, and I'm just speaking for you, that it's in
know.
Your face, so you know.
I know what it is. Yeah. I see a face, I see a name. right? I feel the uncomfortability. I'd rather know that and face that than not know that and not face
you know,
that.
You know what's interesting about that, Jose? And we'll use this as a pivot, actually, to your book, because Jean-Paul Sartre wrote in The Atlantic in 1947, I believe it was, don't quote me, but that he was never freer than when the Nazis occupied France. And I'm not comparing this government to the Nazis, but what he was saying was that by having his somebody in front of his face who ideologically was on the polar opposite of where he was at, actually freed him up to live his life with intention and purpose at every single turn. And that sounds like what you're saying right now when you're saying that at least you know it's right there in front of your face.
And you know, Trump is only the culmination of all the lies and the myths and the delusions we've told ourselves about who we are as a country and how we got to be. Right. I was just in Mississippi promoting the book, and it was at the Hattiesburg at the University of Southern Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And before the book event, I had this like small dinner of like 20 kids, 18 white, 2 black, and they were all proud conservatives. Mm-hmm. And then I started, you know, talking, and the election was about to come up, like the midterms. Mm-hmm. And then one of the students said, "Do you vote?" And I'm like, No, I'm undocumented. Yeah, yeah. Like, what am I going to vote with? My Bank of America debit card? Like, she was like, "What do you mean? Like, my dad says y'all vote." And then while I'm talking, she actually calls her dad, Chuck, and gives me the phone. Can you tell my dad that you can't vote? And then I started thinking that this is a young woman, she's a freshman in college, that has grown up, right? There's an entire media ecosystem, you know, from Drudge to Breitbart to Fox News to The Daily Caller to Breitbart, right? That has been created, that has created this false narrative of what this is. And no matter what the New York Times, Washington Post, or NPR said, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but the reason, I mean, and we can get into the media theory of this, and as somebody who worked for The Times, you know this, but the reason that these sites are able to thrive, and the reason actually, you know, regardless of one's personal feelings about the president or people in his administration, the truth of the matter is there are many people who are worried, and he articulates what many people feel.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
You know, when you go into rural, so Hattiesburg, for example, Mississippi, I've spent a lot of time there. This is an area where a lot of Latinos are moving, especially after Hurricane Katrina. And they're having a very hard time adjusting because, again, there's this cultural intersection of Hattiesburg was already had a lot of problems before folks start arriving. And now all of a sudden when folks start arriving, it's easy to say, well, you know, these problems have only been exacerbated or made worse by the folks who are coming here.
So let's actually unpack this. And this is the beauty of radio, that we can do this. Let's actually unpack this, right? When I was researching my book, I reread John F. Kennedy's very small but very potent book called A Nation of Immigrants.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book, actually. Yeah.
It's a beautiful book.
Yeah, I've read that as well.
I read it, and, you know, I'm a journalist, so I like numbers, right? And so I tried to really avoid to just, you know, basically fill this my book with numbers. But the number that really stood out to me in the book, in John F. Kennedy's book, was between 1776 and 1963, according to his book, 42 million immigrants moved to the United States. 42 million. Mostly from, of course, from Europe, right? This was the Ellis Island era, mm-hmm. right? And then, because of what Kennedy did and the Kennedy brothers did, the 1965 Immigration Nationality Act, between 1966 and 2016, 43 million immigrants moved, mostly from Latin America and mostly from Asia. So think about that. In a span of 187 years, 42 million, mostly white, mostly European. And then in a span of 50 years, 43 million people move. That's a lot of change in a country that can't even talk about black people without having a panic attack. Right. In
many people ways, can't talk country, about black people. Yes. Yeah.
But meaning this country still has not grappled with what it has done systematically with black people in this country, why white was created so there was black, right? So they can't even handle that. And now you're putting Latinos and Asians and mixed race people right on top of it. So that's a lot of change. And that's why I think our role in the media, may it be journalism, filmmaking, all of it, the stories we tell, right, and how we tell these stories and how we insist on these dots being connected is of utmost importance. Utmost importance.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a journalist. He's an activist. He's the author of Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. We're going to spend the last 10 minutes talking specifically about your book. And I want to talk about why you decided to frame the book into three parts, lying, passing, yeah, hiding. Tell us why you decided that this was important.
Well, first of all, I didn't really want to write this kind of book. Originally, I wanted to do a global migration book. I wanted to write a book about the fact that there's 258 million migrants in the world, and many of us are moving to countries that previously colonized or imperialized us, right? And then my editor was like, nope, we're not doing that book.
Wow.
Instead, she said, I wanna understand why you are the way you are, right? Why are you so broken?
I want to stop you. Do you feel broken?
Oh, yeah.
Before we get into the book thing, I'm gonna take this for a left turn, which is like, why do you feel broken, and how do you carry that around with you?
It's unnatural for a kid to be separated from his or her parent. That's unnatural. I haven't seen my mom since I left the Philippines. I was 12, 25 years.
How do you talk to her?
Actually, that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to understand that. I wanted to understand why I can't talk to her, why I have such a hard time trying to understand our own dynamic.
Are you
what
angry
separation
at her?
Has done with us. What was that?
Are you angry at her, or do you feel shame?
Oh, when I was young, I was really angry at her because I didn't understand why a mom would give up her son. I didn't understand that. I thought it was very selfish. I thought maybe she didn't want me. Maybe she didn't really want me. And she didn't really want to have me as a kid. Maybe that's what it was. Like the kind of abandonment that I think a lot of, you know, kids lived through. So I went through that. And then, of course, I got in my mid-20s and I realized how selfish of mine to think that. That in many ways, she made the ultimate sacrifice. But then at that point, I was 25, 26, right? Like, you know, 15 years had passed. And so how do you say to someone you miss them if you hadn't seen them for 25 years?
You know, it was interesting that you said this about being broken and about being angry with your mom, because you were recently on a panel, I believe it was in Austin, with Reina Grande, the Mexican-American author.
Yeah.
And I heard Reina in Orange County recently, and she was saying that she was so angry with her parents because in them trying to provide a better, just more full life, in coming to the United States, they actually succeeded in breaking the family, and that was one of the common threads of being an immigrant in the United States, is that almost by trying to save the family, you end up breaking it.
And we don't talk about that. Like, there's no meaning, you know, we have this kind of usual tropes about, we brought you here for a better life. You know, you live in both worlds. You know, kind of that duality of identity. But my goal in this book was really talk about trauma. You know, I have to say, Bob Ross, the CEO of the California Endowment, which supports what we do at Define America, and he read the book, and he and I did an event together in LA. And after he read it, he said, Jose, this is not what I expected. Because I guess he thought I was going to write a policy book. And then he goes, you know, this book is about trauma. And I looked at him and I was like, yes, that's what it is. I wanted to write about really mental health. I wanted to understand what it means when you not only are separated from your family, but when you're separated from your government. This is my government. This is where I've lived. This is where I pay taxes, a lot of taxes, which I'm happy to pay because I love public schools and I love public libraries. Like, this is where I became who I am, and yet this country doesn't want to recognize me. I do not have the right to vote. I do not have a say in politics. So what happens when you're separated from it? How does the severance from the government leads to the severance from the self?
I wanted
to understand that.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, it's okay. I wanted to understand that.
I want to ask you some personal questions, if I may.
These haven't been personal enough. No, but it's in the book. All of this is in the book.
I get it. I want people to go buy your book as well. Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen, go buy the book. Jose, how does this brokenness play out in your relationships, specifically like romantic relationships and interpersonal relationships with friends? The reason I'm asking this is because...
Yeah, no, I wrote about it, and I'm trying to figure out how to explain this to you. So I thought all these years that I was only hiding from the government, right? Like I was visibly, I was like hiding in plain sight, right? Because I was writing for the Washington Post. I mean, you know, my name was on the papers and yet I'm here illegally and I didn't want people to know that. And so I didn't realize that all those years that I was hiding from the government, I actually ended up hiding from people. People who wanted to get to know me, people who wanted to get close, right? Because that's the thing. Like you can't, if you can't talk about who you are and where you come from, how do people understand who you are? So actually, for me, I was lucky that I was in a profession where I was asking questions. So I always was deflecting. I was like, I'm the one who asks questions here. I don't answer them. Right? So when people ask me, say, how's your mom doing?
Yeah.
Oh, how's your mom doing? Yeah. So how about you? How's it going? That's what I would do.
You know what's interesting is I've met so many journalists. I hate to say that, I'm not trying to make it about myself, but myself included, who love to ask questions because it helps them deflect from having to answer questions, especially if they're people who've lived through trauma.
And I didn't. And so this book was my attempt to put language in it. You know, even the way I wrote this book, I wanted it to kind of underscore my life, meaning the book is written as if this person's in a hurry, right? Because my life has always been in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one thing to the next. It's one thing to the next, and you don't know where you're going to go. You don't know where you're going to. So I wanted to kind of capture that within the rhythm of the book.
We're going to hear from one last caller, Jose, in just a moment, and we're going to end the show with her. She's read your book. But what did you – I just want to know before we go to her, what did you learn about yourself through writing this book?
Oh, God.
What did you find about yourself that you didn't know existed within you before you started
See,
on
when I was a kid, there was this movie that I was obsessed by, The Hours. It was a wonderful novel by Michael Cunningham, and it got made into this miraculous movie that was even better than
with
the book.
With Nicole Kidman. Yeah, it is a beautiful movie about time and space and family.
It's a beautiful movie about depression. It's a beautiful movie about depression.
Okay.
I don't think there's been a movie quite like that about grief and depression. But there was a point in the movie where she says, you know, to look life in the face, to know it for what it is, to love it for what it is, and then to put it away. I think because I've been carrying this around all these years, I was so busying myself with writing other people's stories, so I didn't have to write my own. And the clarity that this book gave me, right? Like the clarity. I make so much more sense to myself now. And now I know how I have to fix the relationships that I've abandoned, right? And I realize how hard it is to be friends with me because I don't open up, right? I abandon people in the way that I was abandoned.
Gabriella, we're going to read your comment. We can't go to you because of time. I'm sorry, Jose. I gotta end this.
Oh,
she
no,
said,
it's okay.
I want you to know that Gabriella in Oakland said that she read the book because she is also an immigrant. It reflects her experience. You're obviously making a connection. The book is called Dear America, Notes of an Undocumented Citizen. The author, Jose Antonio Vargas, who joined us. Jose, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm John Sepulveda, in for Michael Krasny. This has been Forum. Join us tomorrow.